from none other than L.A. veteran Lizzie Gray. Oh, shit. That's him now. Lizzie, is that you?
Yeah.
Well, fucking A. How you doing?
What's up?
Well, if anyone knows more about the Los Angeles scene, it's you. I mean, you've never left the place, right?
Yeah. Wow. Born and raised.
Born and raised. Didn't you ever want to get out? Well, we're going to talk a lot about those early days.
All the years of doing the whole rock scene in Hollywood, my memories of it were so great. I remember you mentioned Cream Magazine. Rodney's English Disco, the star, the whole Sunset Strip scene in the 70s and 80s was just this really rare moment in musical history.
Yep, tell us more, Lizzie.
Even though you might have been struggling and the record companies might be turning their backs on you, there was a scene that was so alive and so real that it didn't matter, but it was just there to be a part of the scene, and that's what it was. It was a real high point, a renaissance for Los Angeles as the music capital of the world.
Take us back to L.A. in the 70s. What was that time like for you as a budding musician, trying to put a band together and going to gigs?
Well, I got really lucky. I mean, as I got sucked into the Hollywood rock scene, it was just a blossoming time for it. And so I was looking for musicians to play with, to work with, at clubs like the Starwood or the Troubadour. And I ended up getting really lucky. And at a fairly early stage in my career, I ended up finding people to work with that we hit the nerve. We knew who our influences were, the New York Dolls, Mott the Hoople, the Sweet, bands like that. And when I hooked up with a guy named Frank Barana, who ended up becoming a guy named Mickey Six, that was like the beginning of us getting a whole lot of connections together. For as budding, you know, Hollywood seamsters, but you got to realize that during the 70s, towards the middle and the end of it, it was a scene where it was kind of like, you know, bands like the Knack and the newly reformed punk scene were starting to come in, and we were out there looking like the Dolls and the 70s glitter bands, and it was a real shock. People were so into it all, and it was working, so Hollywood was like this fantasy land. I mean, in one club you might see some crazy over-the-top metal band like I can't remember some of the names of these bands, but the punk scene was real strong. And then you'd go to another place, there'd be a big glam show going on. And then when metal started revitalizing in the end of the 70s and the early 80s, then suddenly that scene was happening. So you had the 80s metal and the 70s glitter and glam and the late 70s punk and skinny tie pop rock. And I mean, it was a circus. It was just an ongoing circus, and there was nothing but just brilliant fun. It was just brilliant fun being a part of the whole music making scene.
What do you remember about that initial encounter or conversation meeting Nikki Six?
Well, ironically, when I first saw him, he had red spiky hair and he looked just like John Waite from the Babies. Babies were one of those bands that were in that whole period of time, very popular, but they didn't quite get over the top. But their influence on the whole rock scene was really strong. And I thought Nikki, when I first met him, was Frank. I thought he looked like John Waite. I said, "Hey man, you're a John Waite lookalike." We had this kind of a funny encounter. At the time, we were putting together a band called Sister. I was working with a guy named Blackie Lawless, and he was really, at the time, his name was Blackie Guzman. I think he didn't pick the name because it was some kind of a serial killer or something. I don't know where he got the name, or a boxer. Something bad had happened to him. Anyway, so Blackie and I were looking for musicians, and we ran an ad in the Recycler, which is just like a cheap little version of what now is called Craigslist, the Recycler, on hard copy. And Frank answered our ad, and when I met him, I really liked him. I thought he just had a great personality, and he had a lot of energy, like rock energy. But Blackie was kind of put off by him. We went to do some recording out in South Bay, and Blackie fired him after the recording. recording session, and I was so bummed that when I talked to Frank again, I told him, I said, you know, Mikey's a good guy, but I don't think he really knows where he's going. Let's put something together. And that's when Nikki and I, Frank and I, started putting in all the pieces of it together, what ended up becoming a band called London.
What kind of character was Blackie? And did the three of you all bond together?
Yeah, well, Blackie, for some reason, just didn't seem to have a lot of respect for Frank or for Nikki at the time. I think he just didn't buy into him. He thought he was kind of a poser, and which is kind of funny, because Blackie was such an, everybody had always accused him of being an Alice Cooper wannabe. And so, you know, it was just one of those weird things. But the chemistry between Frank and Nikki and I, that was just awesome. I mean, we just really hit it off. And we knew exactly what we wanted. I mean, we wanted to be the new New York Dolls. We wanted to be the new Mott the Hoople. Once we had decided where we were going with this thing, the sky was the limit. We had so much fun, like, putting little flyers and things up on the telephone poles. We were one of the first bands that ever did that. And some of those posters are now selling on eBay in the hundreds of dollars.
Nice. Well, we all know that metal and hard rock dominated the L.A. scene in the 80s. But at the time of bands like Sister, was heavy music appreciated then?
Well, yeah, well, Sister ended up obviously becoming Wasp. But at the time when Blackie was trying to put Sister together, it had started out in the early 70s. And I guess his timing just wasn't really good, and so it didn't really come together for the band Sister. And then he was kind of going nowhere at the moment, you know, around 1978, 79. And that's when London was just, we were just escalating and just going into this massive exposure mode. We were playing shows at the Starwood, and we were selling out 2,000 and 3,000 seats. I mean, it was packed. It was just, they'd have to turn people away. And so for London, 78, 79 was a great time. For Blackie, I don't think he was really doing anything he wants to talk about. His whole moment came when the 80s resurgence, the whole real metal thing that was real based around bands like Ozzy and Alice and stuff like that. That when that scene came in, that suited Blackie's Sister thing, and he was able to kind of pull it out and make it make sense for him. There was always a conflict between Nikki, myself, and Blackie, because Nikki always was just like me. He was very much influenced by the pop rock, you know, the Cheap Trick, the Mott the Hoople, the Sweet Slade, bands like that. And that kind of English glitter rock was a huge influence on both Nikki and I. Not so much on Blackie. He seemed to have a different take on things. He was ripe for the real heavy metal thing, even though I think he was a huge Beatles fan, and he loved the really poppy stuff, but I used to tell him, I go, you can love it, but you can't sing it.
So with London, it was a glitter explosion, but then the glam thing pretty much made its comeback on the L.A. scene in 85, wouldn't you say?
I would say yes, yeah. I used to have a great conversation with a friend of mine from the Dolls, Arthur Kane, and he was a wonderful, wonderful guy. He used to talk about glitter rock and about the New York Dolls. He said, you know, people don't realize that this massive amount of music and musical influence all happened in about 2 years, from 1974 to 1976. Because that was really the moment for glitter rock, for the glam metal glitter kind of thing that he'd talk about it real fondly. And he just goes, we were so lucky to be at that moment in time. It was after that, you know, period that, in at least in L.A., the scene really changed to that kind of like punk pop new wave. In fact, when people talk about the 80s, there's a split, because some people will say, yeah, the 80s, that was metal. That was when all the metal bands with the big hair and all that was going on. And then everybody else goes, no, that was when the new wave was going on with the pop and the Tears for Fears and all that.
Right.
There was so much going on. You had, if you were a musician, you had to be doing something great.
Yeah. So was playing the Starwood back then the ultimate goal, or were there bigger dreams?
Oh, yeah, there was definitely bigger dreams. I mean, I think mine was that we wanted to be the next to the level of Kiss, who we just thought, you know, they who had made their gigantic mark over a 4 or 5 album period. They just became this huge thing, which still are, more or less. I mean, it's not like it was, but we pictured that we would escalate this project to being the level of Kiss.
Yeah.
And ironically, Nicky pulled that off, man. He grabbed the brass ring on that one with Motley Crue. And ironically, Motley started out playing the London, two or three London songs, so that was kind of ironic, too.
Okay, now after the London days with Nicky, you decided to team back up with Blackie for another incarnation of London. What was the deciding factor in doing that?
Well, you gotta realize, and I gotta be honest, I love Blackie, he's a great guy, but I mean, during the time of the period of time when London, rulers of the Strip, during that period of time, Blackie wasn't doing anything. I mean, there was nothing happening with Blackie. And so when London lost Nigel Benjamin, who was the singer that helped catapult us to that level, because A, he had a great set of lungs on him, but B, he had a great songwriting ability as well. And so when we lost Nigel, went through a couple changes looking for a singer to replace him that had the magic quality. And for whatever reason, I think that London was the best thing that had ever happened to Nigel, because when he was in Mott the Hoople after Ian Hunter, nothing really happened for that band, and the record that they did was okay, but it was kind of like it didn't make any sense. I think if Nigel would have had a little more respect for the position that the London Band of Hollywood was putting him in, I think that there wouldn't even be a Motley Crue. It would be called London.
Wow, that's interesting.
Where we thought we could revitalize the project, and I went back to Blackie and said, hey man, you want to give it a shot? He goes, because he loved the pop stuff, and ironically that's when he ended up recording one of my songs. It's called Chasing a Rainbow,
right,
which is a really just really light Beatles-esque pop tune, and there's copies of that floating around on cassette all over, and people just freak out when they hear Blackie singing this song Chasing a Rainbow.
No doubt. Check out Glambone's YouTube page for a video clip that I put together for that song.
The Blackie project didn't last long. It lasted maybe 5 or 6 months, and nothing really came of it. It was just another step of London kind of slipping down another notch. And then when Blackie left London, I think actually I left London at the same time, but whatever the reason, it wasn't happening anymore, so... that's when things, shifted, for me anyway, and that's when Blackie kind of, I told Blackie, I said, Blackie, you're great at being a monster. I said, use your devil voice and do your best, and I go, that's what you do best, and he took my advice and wasp with everything that was, so that worked out great.
Absolutely, and after that, you had brief stints with other projects, such as Roxy Roller and St. Valentine. Were those bands just to keep busy, or did you put your heart and soul into making those work?
When London kind of bottomed out, that's when I started looking for other projects, but I mean, it was definitely a heartfelt thing. And St. Valentine, the version that I was in was with Desi DeMalls, with Desi Rex, who ended up calling himself Desi DeMalls with his band DeMalls. And he was a great guy, he was a lot of fun. But yeah, there was that period where, in that lull, I was trying to find the right chemistry, and you got to realize that timing-wise, the 80s had become much, much more heavy, much more metal, a lot less 70s influence, a lot less of pop glitter, David Bowie, T-Rex, Mark Bolan, a lot less of that, and a lot more of Eddie Van Halen, shredder, heavy metal guitar player. So the 80s was really a lot different than the 70s. The 70s had punk, pop, glitter, you name it, they had it. And in the 80s, it became pretty much that people started coming to L.A. from the country because they wanted to be a part of this 80s metal thing. And it started to become more and more generic. And I think that was the difference. I mean, the 70s was very colorful and different. And
yeah.
The 80s was more generic. More and more, everybody was just trying to be David Lee Roth and Eddie Van Halen. It was still a heck of a lot of fun. But I didn't really thrive in that environment, because even though I've always considered myself and been rated as a pretty shredder guitar player myself, I never really prided myself in that direction. I always considered myself more of a songwriter and a pop enthusiast. And so the 80s, doing bands like St. Valentine, and Roxy Roller. I really was just trying to find that pop niche and keep doing what I did best. And unfortunately, it didn't really fly with the heavy metal that was happening. The Motley Crue managed to ironically kind of tie it together. They used a lot of the London pop sensibilities, but they mixed it with the more metal-esque guitar and the big double kick drums of Tommy Lee. That really, they kind of borrowed everything they wanted from the 70s and moved on in the 80s to become a massive force to be reckoned with.
Lizzie, what's the story behind Public Enemy Number 1? Obviously, you were aware Nicky was playing this song with Crew during the club days. What were your thoughts on that? And at what point did Nicky come to you and tell you the song was going to be recorded for Too Fast for Love?
He came at me and told me that by me finding out that Elektra Records was releasing the album. So, yeah, I had no idea. And I think it was on the leather version, too, the leather records. No, he never mentioned anything to me. He never said anything. He just used the tune. And ironically, I ended up contacting Elektra when I found out that they were going to run with that album. And I said, hey, you got a song on there that you don't have a release for. That's my song. I want to, get some coverage on this. And so the person at Elektra who I spoke with was very stressed out. They're like, oh no. And apparently they contacted Nicky and his management and said, well, what's going on? This guy says he wrote this song and he's making noise here. And so Nicky ended up calling me up and he goes, here, you got two choices. Choice one, you leave the song on the album. I take half credit for it and everything's fine. Choice two, we just drop it off the album and you disappear. So I took choice one. I said, okay, that's fine. And I've got to be honest, I feel fortunate that a song that I wrote that was all about, the whole sensibility of a part of the underground scene, that it became a part of the massive Motley Crue thing. I mean, at this point in my career, I just consider it something else, another song I wrote and another thing that I did. So it's all really good. There's no hard feelings at all. However, at the time, when you were in the middle of it, there was, you got to realize it, well, I'm sure you realized it all through the 80s, especially the 80s, there was a massive amount of competition between the bands. Because everybody wanted to get that next Elektra, Warner Brothers, Capitol, whatever, record deal.
Were you given credit, though, on the early pressing of the Leather Records release?
Oh, no. He had given us, on the Leather Record, my name was on it. It was Al Gray under as a songwriter for that song. So, no, at no time did he try to just flat out say, this is my song. He just failed to notify me, when the royalties were coming around. So that was when I wanted to get something going with that, and so it was a positive thing.
But was it a 50-50 split between you and Nicky?
He gave me half credit. Yeah, he did give me half credit on the song, which, I mean, that becomes one of those questions where it's like, yeah, I wrote the lyrics, started putting it together, we all worked on it. To tell you the truth, songwriting, to try to hoard songwriting, ironically, I heard horrible stories from Andy Piper told me that as a guitar player in Wasp that Blackie was really horrible about just maintaining complete credit on everything without really, handing it out, passing it around freely. The truth is, does it really, would I have done something if I would have wanted to collect my royalties. I mean, that's about it as far as Public Enemy Number One. I wouldn't have said, you can't record this song. I'm gonna get an injunction against your record or something. I would never go that route. And it didn't. It was just a little positioning, a little saber rattling, and then everything was peachy keen.
Cool. So, of course, Too Fast for Love was their own self-release at first. Did you think much would come from it?
The truth? I'll be honest with you, I really didn't think that much of it. I thought that there was it had moments. I thought that it had an honesty about it. But, I was coming off the high of London. And, I mean, in 79... the London songs were people were just enthralled with them. There was a depth of songwriting that surpassed just, strutting around. It really, these were songs that were, not just that I had a hand in writing them, because I did. I mean, we all wrote songs that were in the part of that band. And again, with the level of songwriting that Nigel Benjamin brought in, I really really felt that that was one of the great strengths of London, besides being, you know, a crotch rock band or whatever you want to call it. You know, that's my positioning when I heard the Leather version. I thought the songwriting was okay, and I thought that it sounded okay. But I honestly, I mean, I'm not saying it as a put down. I wasn't knocked out by it the way the rest of the world was. And I think that it was really their live show that really made it all happen for them. I mean, they became personalities, and at that point, then when that transcends, when you become just a personality that people recognize as the music, that's when you transcend all the rules, and you're, you know, you're that level. That's when you reach that level.
Absolutely. Much in the way how Kiss became personalities. So what was it like for you to see Motley explode the way they did, knowing it was one of your old bandmates?
Well, you know, everybody wants to see, I mean, I'm sure there's everybody that knew you when, you know, I mean, that's the whole thing. I knew you when. It was tough to do because of my own foible, you know, that I was still pursuing, you know, holding a torch for the London style of music. And so not only was I watching Motley Crue escalate to that level of Kiss stature that I wanted to attain, but I'm sure there's a million other kids that have the same expectations. I think that's why Gene Simmons had that song, Great Expectations. I think that, that everybody wanted that. I mean, and sure, I'm no exception. But at the same time, I think what was more frustrating to me was that I was still very much embedded in that 70s rock style, and so I wasn't really completely excited about what was happening with the 80s scene. So I kind of saw Motley's success as some kind of an anomaly and something that didn't really make sense to me, because I was still so attached to the lighter pop side of the rock thing.
Okay, but you would later see the same thing happen with Izzy and Slash from Guns N' Roses and Fred Curry from Cinderella. Did you ever say to yourself, why them and not me?
Well, again, I gotta say that my biggest problem, well, if you want to call it a problem, I guess you might call it a vexation. If somebody wants to achieve something, then they need to at least know who their audience is and who they're trying to achieve it with. I think that at the time, when we were doing London, that the band had become like a legend. You know, it's almost like everybody knew who London was, and they knew that London was a band that if you got in that band, you were probably going to become a rock star.
Totally.
And we had people come and want to join the band just for that reason, even though it had gone through so many metamorphoses and had very little to do with what it had been in the 70s. In the 80s, there still was this whole plethora of people wanting to jump on board the London bandwagon. And ironically, it just became like almost unbelievable that here's this band, and everybody, it starts out as Nikki Sixx, it's Blackie Lawless, then the next level up, talking like the mid 80s, now all of a sudden it's Slash, it's Izzy Stradlin, it's Steve Adler, and they all were in London for some period of time, and it was the same thing. Little funny anecdotes that you get from those moments. I mean, when I first met the guys ended up becoming Guns N' Roses. They became Guns N' Roses. When I first met them, it was because this guy who was knocking at my door. This young kid, he was about 18. He's holding a bottle of champagne in his hand, and he says, "Hey, man," he goes, "I want to play drums for you. My name's Steve," and it was Steven Adler, and. He was a really sweet guy, but for whatever reason, his performance didn't work for the other members of London at the time, and so that didn't really pan out. But before he was no longer with the project, he brought his buddy Izzy by, and then Izzy brought his friend, whose name was Saul at the time, and he brought Saul by, and I guess Saul ended up becoming Slash. And I jammed with him. I thought that he had a good style, and he had a really good sense of guitar riffs, kind of like a raunchier version of Joe Perry. And so I really liked his playing. But for whatever reason, chemistry didn't come together. And then those guys ended up putting their old band back together with with Axl. It wasn't before. For one moment there, around, I guess it was probably 85, 86, Izzy was saying, hey, a friend, well, you might want to bring in to sing for the band instead of the guy you got, because I'm not really crazy about them. And the guy who Izzy wanted to bring in was a guy named Bill.
Right.
And Bill turned out to, Bill, his last name was Bailey, Bill Bailey. And Bill turned out to be Axl.
Yeah, obviously.
So, I mean, I guess I just feel, like, fortunate to have been, you know, been around these bands. I don't really want to take credit for any of their success, but if whenever they want to record any of my songs, they're always, of course, welcome to.
But, Lizzy, does their success haunt you? Do you struggle with any of that?
No, not at all. Not at all. It's almost like, you know, the more recordings that I've released, Spiders and Snakes, which, you know, is a band that I've been doing for 20-plus years now. You know, the more recordings I make with that, and the more I get to examine what is my real roots in music, what I really like to do, the more I do that, the more I any sense of sadness or remorse that things didn't, you know, I didn't get the platinum press, the more that goes away, and it's just replaced by... You reach a point where you think, this is really great. I'm just doing it because I love it, not because I think I'm going to be a rock star. Right. That's a massive, huge hurdle to get across. Most people don't. You know, when it stings them as hard as I was stung, they might just say, I can't do this anymore. But for me, all the things that I did accomplish and all the touring and the playing and the shows, I mean, that it's more than makes up for the fact of saying, gosh, I'm not a rock star, darn it. I mean, I've had people call me legend, you name it. The inferences are endless of, you know, somebody who would consider themselves extremely successful. Do I consider myself extremely successful? I'm not a household word, but I'm not a slouch.
The thing is, Lizzy, obviously, these guys that you played with know your strength as a songwriter. One would think it would be a no-brainer to call you up and say, hey, Lizzy, want to write a tune for my next record, you know?
Yeah, you know who did that was Fred Corey before he was doing that band Arcade with Stephen Piercy from Rat. Fred used to come up to me at the clubs all the time and go, hey, man, I want to write some songs with you. I want to do some songs with you. I'm working with Piercy now, and for whatever reason, that project never really turned into anything. That was post-Rat for Piercy. But, I mean, ironically, Steve is still playing out everywhere. I mean, he's doing great. You know, these guys, they're playing their own music like they were a top 40 band. they're playing their own covers, so that's cool, and I think it's great. I mean, as long as it's real, people will still buy into it.
Yep, just like people always seem to buy into douche bands.
Douche band of the month.
Our douche band this month chose their name after deciding if Pretty Boy Floyd had a gay cousin, its name would be Queenie Blast Pop. So, Lizzy, does it upset you that people still want to ask you about Nikki and the early days?
No, I'm used to it because it's funny when they go, oh, you're Earl Grey. That's been my whole lot through my musical career. Was, oh, you're that guy that wrote the Motley Crue song. You're the guy that wrote the Motley Crue song.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't really have a problem with it at all. I mean, it's something I do and did, and like I said, I prefer to be recognized for what I've done with Spiders and Snakes, but... You know, that remains to be seen.
When you put together Ultra Pop, that first record had some real gems on it. I thought you definitely found yourself as an artist.
Yeah, and there was some real experimentation on that record with 70s pop. A lot of very heavy T-Rex, Mark Bolan, you know, a little Bowie thing going on. It was an influence of all the British glitter rock. And I really wanted to put it together. When I left London for the last time when I said, that's it, no more London bands, I'm not gonna pursue this anymore. When I left that project for good, I said, I'm going to do a solo thing, I'm going to do ultra pop, I'm going to do what is, you know, me doing me. And for the first time, I started doing lead vocals, and that was another thing. It's like I was all through the 70s and 80s. I mean, I just never considered myself, you know, to the level that I really wanted to be a lead singer. That all changed when I did the ultra pop record. Yeah. And I said, hey, I think I'm ready for that. I'm ready for that. I mean, I'm ready for the being the front guy, not just putting together the whole project thing, but being the guy. And, but I will say one thing, even to this day, I love playing guitar. I mean, guitar is who I and what I am. It's hard to put the guitar down when, you know, the rest of the band saying, hey, do a couple of songs as a front man, put that guitar down.
Right. And you were right on the cusp of power pop taking over, though. Bands like the Lemonheads, Jellyfish, Red Cross. Why did you then resort back to the shock rock theme with Spiders and Snakes?
Because it wasn't really shock rock. I mean, to be perfectly honest, ultra pop was really just what it sounded like. Ultra pop, a lot of people probably didn't get it. They thought of ultra pop as Michael Jackson or something. But it was really, ultra pop was just a name. And again, like, since people didn't really fully comprehend where it was coming from, when I hooked up with Timmy and we started Spiders and Snakes, it was really just a continuation of ultra pop. And we, even though the song, the name Spiders and Snakes evokes kind of a tipping of the hat to the 80s metal thing, it's really not. It's really just that we heavied up some of the material just a little bit because it was fun. At that point, it was fun. It was almost like anything goes. We'd look at ourselves and go, my God, we've been doing this for 20 or 30 years now. You know, what are we doing? And we just said, let's just do what we want to do. And so there really are no real rules with Spiders and Snakes songs other than that it has to be fun. It's got to be something that's catchy that we really, you know, that has that recurring melodic harmonies and recurring choruses that are just where you just go, this is fun, this is great music. I mean, that's where we're at now. So it's not really that we may have missed it. I mean, I don't know, because, you know, that's more of a business question. And I've always been lousy at business. yeah, you may have a very valid point. Ironically, that album Ultra Pop, when it first came out, it was in 1988. That album got 5,000 reviews from Kerrang magazine, and a guy named Malcolm Dome, who was just raving about the record. And that was at the time when metal was still just raging, and we got our 5Ks right up next to Iron Maiden, you know, which is, you know, absolutely, it was like the two genres of music couldn't have been further apart. But it all works, you know, I mean, it all works if you're open-minded. There's no rules, really.
Right. So tell me, what's your favorite Lizzie Gray song you've written?
My favorite Lizzie Gray song, that's a good question. I gotta say, there's a song called Radio Stars that, I don't know how many times that's been, I mean, I don't know how big that song ever got, but Radio Stars is one of my most, that's a song we played back in the London days, and in the early first London band with Nicky and Nigel, and that song, Radio Stars, is one of my, I consider one of my really shining moments, and that song, ironically, here's some politics for you. There's a riff in the middle of a song Motley Crue has called Don't Go Away Mad, Just Go Away. And the riff in the middle of that song is exactly Radio Stars. And Nicky used to play Radio Stars with us. So I think he was taking a little shot there, just a little one. Not, you know, but there's a little barb there. And I don't know what he was implying, if there was an implication or if I was just throwing it on myself because to feel better. That song, Radio Stars. And I have another one called Siamese Twins, which I actually wrote in retort to him releasing that song with Radio Stars riff in it. And it's called Siamese Twins. And it's just about a guy. It's about two guys that are both trying to achieve something. And no matter how well one guy does it, the other guy gets the success from it. So
yeah.
I guess they're the little Heckle and Jekyll, nothing of fun going on between Nikki and I, but we've talked and had great conversations now and again. And so it's that kind of competitive thing. It's just more of a fun thing for the moment.
Legendary Hollywood manager Vicki Hamilton agreed with me that you are one of the unsung heroes of Hollywood. How does that make you feel to hear that?
It makes me feel great. And then, like I said, I mean, I gave it everything I had, and I still do. And that's why it works, because it's real, you know. And that's really great that Vicki would say something like that. We definitely appreciate it. And, yeah, I mean, I don't mind being an unsung hero as long as I can still sing at all. So, yeah, I'm still well into it. I mean, and you know what? It's like there. It's like a tattoo. It's not going to go away. And if you really love it, then it doesn't just make your life. It is your life. And I don't mean that as opposed to having families and things like that. But as far as who and what you are and what you do, there's really nothing to be less than proud of than saying, I love rock and roll, and this is what I do.
Right on. Well, Lizzie, we're going to wrap it here. And it's been great talking with you. Rock and roll, Lizzie. Rock and roll.
Take care. Bye-bye.
There you have it, glitter gurus. Until next time, we'll see ya.